Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast.
Serotalk Podcast.
Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast, your portal to the accessible digital lifestyle.
www.serotalk.com.
A production of Serotech Corporation, creators of System Access, the System Access Mobile Network, and SA2Go. Learn about new technology, cool software, useful websites, education, information, entertainment, user comments, and much more. And now, here's your host, Michael Locke.
Welcome to Serotalk. Podcast number 25 for October 12, 2009. This is Michael Loff.
And I'm Ricky Inger.
Well, Ricky, there's a lot of buzz going on the latest Serotech contribution called iBlink Radio.
Yes, we're really excited to be the first company to release a blindness-specific app for the iPhone. And it's actually not blindness-specific.
I would call it maybe a blindness interest app, because anybody can use it. It just has material of special interest to folks who are blind, or those family members and people serving the needs and interests of folks who are blind or visually impaired. So
exactly. And there are even cases where people who are not blind and don't know anyone who is, but that may have some difficulty reading or something like that, they certainly enjoy the radio reading services portion of the iBlink Radio app. This app does include radio reading services along with podcasts and streaming radio stations that are run by blind folks.
And we're always open to suggestions, because I am sure there are a few that I am not aware of. So please send those to resources@serotalk.com, and we will add that content. We're very excited about it. There's a lot of cool stuff out there.
What I'm most excited about is we really hoped for this response, and we've gotten it. People who are not necessarily members of the SAMNet community, they are enjoying iBlink just as much as those who are SAMNet subscribers, because the content is certainly not specific to SAMNet. It's just good stuff to listen to for anybody.
Well, actually, my son installed it so that he could listen to our podcasts.
Nice.
I'm sure some sightlings will be grabbing that as well. But on the subject of iPhone and iBlink Radio and all that good stuff, we invite you to join us this Thursday evening. It's Tech Chat 37. In a publicly available forum called Accessible Events. So you do not have to be a member of SAMNet to participate. We do it Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern or 6 p.m. Pacific. This week's topic, your favorite iPhone apps. And I'm very excited about this one, because I just love to find new and cool accessible applications for the iPhone. And of course, again, if you would like to contribute something to that, if possible, and you hear this in advance, please go ahead and email your favorite app, so that way we can look it up and provide a link to it, so we can have actual direct links to all of these cool apps, so you can hop right over to the iTunes store and grab them.
Yeah, that's one nice thing about doing these presentations in Accessible Event, is that you have content to present that attendees can just go right then and download the app or visit the link on the webpage that you're presenting.
Definitely. And the following week, on October 22nd, we'll mention it, is the release of Windows 7. So we'll be doing Under the Hood of Windows 7 and talking about some things that you really might not know about unless you do some research on the internet. Of course, it's at accessibleevent.com. If you're a SAMNet member, just go into the socializer and you'll get a direct link, or just follow us on Twitter if you've not done so, at twitter.com/Serotalk. And Ricky, on the subject of Twitter, there's been a lot of discussion of late, people's comparisons between Quitter and McTwit.
I have used both programs, and my current personal favorite is Quitter, developed by Christopher Toth and company. And I like it for several reasons. It's nice and stable and has the features that I really appreciate. And it doesn't run in a separate window. You're able to access your tweets regardless of what application you are in at the time. So there's no alt-tabbing over to a different window to check out what's going on. You can simply press a keystroke, read your tweets, and then continue with your business. But McTwit is certainly a nice program as well. And just today, in fact, a version 2.4, is that right, was released?
Yes.
Have you tried this? I have not yet.
I've downloaded it. I haven't installed it yet. He's added the ability, I guess, to get weather conditions and
Driving directions,
neighborhood information. So it's exciting to see what both of these applications, the evolution of them and the things that they're working on. I'm kind of the opposite from you, actually. I'm still using McTwit.
Is that right?
And mainly, I'm just too lazy, I guess, to press three keys for a command. I'd rather just Alt-Tab into the window and arrow through. And, of course, I used McTwit from the beginning, and I did a brief, kind of convoluted demo on the tech chat. So by doing that, I kind of learned. It's a very powerful program, but you have to really look around and be a little geeky to find all of the commands to it. But the point is, whichever one you use or want to use, they're both free. And most of all, I want to encourage people who haven't done so to really think about adding Twitter as a form of communications. Because some people just say, well, I don't really care about what other people eat and what they do. Well, if you're antisocial and really don't care about anyone else, you probably do care about other things going on in the world. And I would argue Twitter is the way that we get news and information, the way we find it, the way we share it with others instead of sending out email messages like we used to.
That's exactly right. I used to be one of those people who kind of publicly scoffed at Twitter, thinking, I don't want to know that somebody's going to get a cup of coffee. And now Twitter is an essential part of my daily routine, both to keep up with what my friends are doing and to keep up with the news around the world and look at what other people are reading, be it about tech gadgets or politics or earthquakes or what have you. It seems that it's far quicker to get news via Twitter than it is to watch TV or listen to the radio or whatever.
I just heard an interesting news article this morning that talked about how Twitter is really hurting newspapers because they can't compete with the timeliness of the information, so that traditional newspapers are going more to investigative journalism, which is good. I hope they find their niche, and I hope they can continue to succeed as the internet erodes their ad dollars. But truly, for the latest information, Twitter is really the tool to get. So if you've been thinking about it, maybe you're unsure, pop into the tech chats. We talk about it some evenings and help people get up to speed, or just go to twitter.com. Or maybe we need to go through Twitter and McTwit and then take questions. Yeah, let's do that. What do you think?
Hey, I think it's an awesome idea.
All right, so let's schedule that for October 29. It's going to be Twitter 101. So if you want to know how it works, the two different programs, the benefits of each, join us, or maybe you want to share your information. What I want to know is people's favorite resources that they follow, especially for news and information. We've done it before, but you know, it's been a few months and neither McTwit nor Twitter were around at that time. And I was using some convoluted piece of garbage for Windows. I don't even recall the name. And there's some other options too. There's OutTwit.
Yeah, I think I was using the website.
Most people were using the website. So now you got OutTwit for Outlook. You've got Syrinx for the Macintosh. You've got apps for your iPhone, Twittero, and
Twittalator.
Tweetini? Yeah. Ricky, I am very excited about the fact that AT&T has decided to now allow voice over IP on their network, meaning while we're traveling, we can make Skype calls.
I'm pretty much saying, hey, it's about time, AT&T. Thank you for dropping at least one of your draconian policies and allowing those of us with iPhones to have voice over IP. And this is not just Skype. This can be perhaps you want to log into your PBX. We have a PBX for Saratech calls, and I'd like to be able to do that even when I'm out on the road. And sometimes I'm not near a Wi-Fi connection, so being able to do this over 3G is quite nice.
What app are you using to do that?
I'm right now using something called WePhone, which used to work, and now I can't get it to log in anymore, and I don't quite know why. WEE Phone.
I promise, folks, we will talk about more than the iPhone, but there was an update that came out last week, iPhone update 3.1.2, and they've squashed three bugs.
Pretty giant update just to fix those three bugs. I think it weighed in at something over 200 megs.
Yes, apparently there was some stability issues where sometimes people would lose connection to their network.
They'd go into coma mode. That was another one where you'd put the iPhone to sleep and couldn't make it wake up again.
I didn't see any issues addressing the battery life, although mine seems to be better after the update. but I haven't had it long enough.
Mine too.
Well, I guess it's time to look at some news from Redmond here. Microsoft, this week in Canada, is demoing up their 5 new multi-touch mice. So were you able to get the gist of these 5 different mice? I really couldn't quite picture them based on the descriptions, and I guess there's some videos. But the main point I wanted to mention this is that, like it or not, folks, touchscreen technology and the gesture-based technologies are coming. They are here. But Microsoft's definitely arriving to the game, obviously, if they've come up with 5 different mice. And keep in mind, these are prototypes at this point.
There actually have been touchscreen-based Windows computers as well. Those haven't really caught on so much yet, I think, because there hasn't been anything really to differentiate using Windows in a touch-based interface as opposed to point-and-click. But, Michael, as you said, touchscreens are here to stay, I think. And it was interesting. I had a conversation the other day with someone who said, why are you getting behind this touchscreen interface given that it is inherently inaccessible to us? And my response was that it's coming whether we like it or not. And I want to be aware of how companies are implementing this type of interface so that my voice and the voices of other blind people can be heard saying, let's change the way you're doing this now. This isn't accessible, or this is accessible. So let's get on board with it so that other manufacturers will choose a path that is both compelling and accessible as far as touchscreens go.
Windows Mobile 6.5, they're adding 2 new features. First off, they are adding a marketplace. So I guess that's where you can go get some applications, maybe even music. I don't know what all they're going to do in their Microsoft marketplace. I guess it's their version of the app store that you have with Apple or under iTunes. But also data synchronization, which supposedly is going to be free. So that might actually be useful, assuming it's accessible, that you can actually back up contacts and important information online so that you have the ability to retrieve it if something were to happen to your phone. But you brought up a very good concern, and that is, are the Windows Mobile screen readers even ready to handle 6.5?
This is something that I can't answer at the moment because I'm no longer using the Windows Mobile platform, but it's something that always happens with the release of a new operating system, be it for the computer or a mobile device. When accessibility is not built in to that platform, you have those who create the screen readers, they do have to play a little catch up. So we may very well be ready for Windows 6.5 in terms of screen readers working with it. And there may, in fact, be some issues that still need to be addressed with that.
One final Microsoft story, and that is the release of their antivirus and malware software called MSE, or Microsoft Security Essentials.
Coolest thing about this is that it's free. I currently use Viper, so I haven't installed this, but it's really gotten some great reviews thus far.
Well, it was interesting because I read a review that said it doesn't scan email attachments, and I thought, man, that's really useless. It really defeats the purpose. But then I realized it was the Sunbelt Software newsletter, who are the makers of Viper.
So you think Viper might be having a little propaganda there?
Possibly. I mean, I read some other articles that say it seems to check out pretty good. And, of course, there's always, some people get hung up on these privacy concerns. It is sending information back to Microsoft. But, folks, there is no such thing as online privacy.
Exactly. I've kind of given up on the idea that that any of my information is private.
Mary Emerson did a review of it over at Blind Cool Tech. Kurzweil K1000 version 12 should be shipping in mid-October, maybe even this week. 64-bit support, Windows 7 support, their use now of the .NET framework. I don't know if that'll be an issue for anyone. I guess if you don't have it installed, I guess it'll prompt you. K1000 is notorious for installing a lot of things anyway. But also the FineReader 9.0.1 and ScanSoft 16.2. There's a new user wizard to kind of help bring newbies up to speed of all the features of it. We'll be curious to see how well that works. Updated or improved currency recognition to recognize the new bills. And it does say it requires a color scanner. Hopefully most people are using color scanners these days. Updates to the American Heritage Dictionary, Roget's Thesaurus. Also, human pronunciation and anagrams, and some updates to the MP3 and Wave recording that it actually makes DAISY 2.02 files with bookmarks.
That's nice. That would be my favorite feature. I don't currently use Kurzweil. I use our own document scan for quick scanning stuff, and if I have anything a little more involved, I use Abby Fine Reader. But the ability to make a DAISY book in MP3 with bookmarks is quite nice. I think it was necessary. I think it was obviously a very smart move for them to include Windows 7 support and 64-bit support. I think it's, $125 to upgrade?
If all you want to do is just scan and read, then certainly take a look at the System Access document scan, because most of the time, that's all I do. I have to say, even though I have the software K1000, most of the time, I open it, scan a document, read it, close it, and I'm on my way.
They also have something called Text Aloud, which will allow you to render books to MP3. Now, I can't automatically have bookmarks in those, but I can transfer them to my Victor or to my iPhone and read on the go that way.
Coming up in this podcast, we are going to interview SAMNET member Michael Breyer, who has not let his lack of eyesight prevent him from being a quality auto mechanic and repair technician. And because people working on automobiles have really been affected by the economy, people are not having any work done on their vehicles unless absolutely necessary. He has started a business about 3 months ago making antenna mounts. Ricky, I bought a new toy and I plan to review it. Hopefully I'll have it by the next podcast.
Oh, what'd you get?
It's called Muzee, M-U-Z-E-E. It took me a little while to get my head around why you would want this, but it is a USB device you plug into your computer to pick up over 13,000 radio stations. As best I understand it from what I've read online, and I don't have it in my hand yet, but it was only $38, but I have read that it is accessible. It basically, I guess, stores or interfaces with a database that gives you 50 categories from over 210 countries, totaling 13,000 radio stations. But I think the best example I can give is it's analogous to our U3 drives. In other words, this is something you can take from computer to computer. Because at first I thought, well, just install the software on the computer. But this way you can set it up with all of your favorites and then just take it with you from machine to machine. And has recording software. You can record anything in Windows Media. So not only can you listen to these 13,000 stations, but record anything that you're interested in. So I'll let you know when I actually get it. You know, can you time shift? Do you need third-party software to convert it from Windows Media? Because it says you can convert to iTunes, but it didn't really say if the application itself has that. I will be talking about that in the next 2 weeks on the 26th when we do our next podcast. It's received 5-star reviews from everyone who has it. It was developed by university students so that they could have this device. They would go in a lab and never know which computer they were going to use and automatically have their favorites set up for it. And they give you earbuds. I don't know if it actually has the audio capability to plug an earphone jack into it, but all that we'll let you know about coming up in 2 weeks on the Zero Talk podcast. Well, as we continue on Zero Talk with our series of interviews with people who are pursuing their vocations and doing the things they love to do and not dreading Monday morning, we caught up with fellow SAMNET member Michael Breyer in Pennsylvania. Where exactly are you in Pennsylvania?
I'm in a little town called Pottstown, Pennsylvania, about 40 miles west of Philadelphia.
You have chosen to work on engines and vehicles as something that you've taken as a hobby. And I believe you said it went back as far as really 13 years old when you first got your hands on engines and have turned it into a career. And what we'll talk about in a few minutes is how, because of the economy, work for rebuilding engines and such is not what it used to be. A lot of people are putting that off unless they absolutely have to. So you've taken up another business to help pay the bills in the meantime, building antenna mounts. But let's start, first of all, with your love for engines and how that began and where you got all the hands-on experience and so forth.
Basically, it started out, I was interested in small engines, and that was about 13 years old. Just started taking them apart, learning on my own, did lawnmower repair, did some trail bike work, built modified engines for the dirt bikes and four-wheelers. I got bored with it. It wasn't a challenge. I always want a challenge. Got interested in cars by hanging around with some friends that were a bunch of, I guess you could say, motorheads. Did a lot of backyard stuff, and that was where I got my first hands-on in automotive. In 11th grade, I went to Votech school, fought like crazy to get in. They told me that nobody would ever hire you. There's no reason why you'd ever want to do this field. You're going to lose your hands in a fan belt or a fan. Or they came up with all kinds of lame excuses, but none that were able to be reasoned with. It almost came down to a discrimination case between me and the school. So eventually they gave in. They found out I'm much more persistent than most students and knew a little bit more about the law than they were expecting. Finally, they left me go to Votech school. No textbooks whatsoever, because the other thing they used against me is, well, there's no one else in the United States that ever worked on the whole car from bumper to bumper. Not many of you really know me that well, but I'm a door opener. And if I'm the one to open a door for somebody else to try something, I'll go ahead and do it. I was the first one employed out of the whole tech school class. No textbooks, no braille information, nothing. Everything was read to me. Basically did, you know, all tests orally. Graduated top of the class of the automotive class. Of course, they all tried to take all the credit for that, but lo and behold, the only one who really, I felt, should have the credit was me, because I'm the one that fought them. If I would have gave in, I would have been just pushed under the carpet, like probably maybe some other people might have been in the past, and I hope not, but, you know, if they did it to me, chances are they'll do it to someone else. Well, the next person that comes along that's blind won't have the problem that I had, because I'm sure they'll remember me for years and years to come. I landed a job through the co-op program, which is half-day school, half-day work, in a repair shop that specialized in high-end exotic cars. Mind you, they were telling me I would never be hired. Here I am working on the rich boy's dream cars, race cars, a lot of the Daytona stuff. Nothing under $30,000 and up to probably $350,000, your Lamborghinis, Ferraris, Rolls, Bentleys. It turned out to be a real good experience. I got 12 years of European experience and all those cars. And I also had a little repair shop on the side for a while I had my job, and turned that into a business. But that's where I got the whole coverage on all the American and Japanese stuff and some small dump truck work. Pretty much, if it's got wheels, my motto is, if it's got wheels and I can find the literature, if I'm lost or stuck, I can fix it. There's no job too big for me, and if it is, I'll be the first one to admit it. You know, then I landed the business. I decided, why make somebody else's money when I can make it myself? So one day, went in, gave my notice, opened up my own shop, and I had that for 5 years, and I'd still have it if I wouldn't have lost the building due to sale of the building, and I wasn't able, you know, in a position to buy it at the time. I took a break from that. I went back to working for some people and running some shops. I'm really a customer person, to be honest with you. I'd rather, at this point in my life, I'd rather deal with the customers and deal with the operation of the shop than the mechanical end of it. Not because I don't know enough, just because it's something different. I'm a people person, really. I have no problem explaining something to somebody or educating them in something that they're not sure of. That's why I had a lot of customers that would never go anywhere else. And they swore by us. Didn't matter if they broke down in New York. Their cars would be towed back for the simple fact that honest work is very hard to find in the automotive field. I hate to say it. It's one of the biggest fields that you could be conned in if you're not educated in your automobile or any automobile. And it's a real shame. It makes it look bad for everybody in the field.
What are some things that we need to be mindful of if we're taking our car into a shop for repair? Some of the gotchas and ways that they kind of get over on some consumers.
The first thing is, I'm not a firm believer of any quick shops. No Pep Boys, Midas, and I'm not here to beat people down. But I'm not a firm believer of that, because they hire people minimum wage, most of them, and they pay you for commission. You're going to find something wrong with that car. That's why I won't work for one of them places, because I don't believe in ripping somebody off. No matter what, every car needs something, and they have a goal to meet. And every number that they meet, the next car has to have a higher number on the bill. And it just keeps going up the ladder. That's why they're big and unstoppable. And the private shops are, you know, smaller and slow right now, which I'd rather be slow, sleep at night, than rip somebody off.
And I saw that in the Better Business Bureau, where people would go to some of these smaller shops and then complain because it took so long for their vehicle to be repaired. So you've got the real catch-22, where the consumers sometimes need to be reasonable about what do they want. Do they want quality service, or do they want a quick in and out and spend money on something that really wasn't necessarily essential?
I have a little motto. It's you get what you pay for. You know, you either want quality or quantity. You can't have both.
So what are some things you would tell someone coming into your repair shop? We used to have tips that we'd give to consumers, like don't try to go in and auto-diagnose and say, here's the problem.
That can be costly on your behalf. If you come in, you can give a roundabout idea of what you think. The first thing I ask somebody is, what is your car doing? What are the symptoms? Not, it has a noise in it, because I'm going to hear noises in your car that they're not going to hear. And then chances are, if I'm chasing after the noise that I'm hearing, their car is not going to be fixed. Then what I would usually do when I had my shop is I'd rather have the customer take an extra day and have their car stuck there and come over and go for a ride with me if it takes that. And let's go out and let's compare notes on what this car really is doing if there's multiple issues. And, you know, if I start fixing multiple issues and you're not pointing out the right problem to me, then it makes it very hard for me to fix your car to your idea of satisfactory. Go for a ride, and they'll drive, and I could pick their car apart from the passenger seat. Guaranteed, I'll find what they're hearing, and some, usually. I go by on what they hear, not by what I hear, because otherwise, if I'm going by what I hear, chances are they're not going to be happy in the end. They're chasing one thing, and I'm chasing another.
Another problem I see, a lot of people buy used vehicles and then upset when a couple of things are wrong. What would you recommend people wanting a new or even a used vehicle do to kind of check the status of it before buying?
Before, I would even pursue going to a reputable shop that you're comfortable with, who can give you an honest opinion on your behalf and not their behalf, is I do a simple thing that it really puts people in a bad spot, and you can sense it right away, is start checking fluids. If you start checking fluids and you find, you know, the oil's black as black can be, the transmission fluid's burnt and smells burnt. If you are blind and you have someone with you that can tell you the transmission fluid's red or if it's really dark, you know that transmission hasn't been serviced. And chances are that vehicle, you're going to want to stay away from, because, you know, if it shows no sign of service, that means it's not going to treat you very well, and it's probably, chances are, going to nickel and dime you. The second thing I recommend is definitely, by all means, ask to take the car to your mechanic that you can trust. Any used car lot, any new car lot selling, you know, used cars, it's your customer right to take that car anywhere you like, whether they go with you or they let you take the car. You take it there. Don't take no for an answer. If they say you can't, you don't want the car.
So have you driven any of these cars that you've worked on?
No, I don't partake in driving any customers' cars.
Right.
Oh, my own?
Yeah.
I'll honestly tell you, one time I got behind the wheel of a Ferrari, and that's no lie. Nothing bad happened because I had reliable guidance. I love sports cars, and I love driving stick. Oh, there's nothing like it. But the more I do it, the more I want to do it, and then I know eventually I'm going to get in trouble. I try not to do it because I just know one day it's going to happen. I just have somebody take a low hand on the wheel, you know, where nobody can see it, and guide me through the turns.
My 21st birthday, driving out to the college, which was about 2 miles, and I drove a boat down the Ohio River. River's a great way if you've never driven before. You have a little bit of margin there.
I've flown before. That was interesting. A friend of mine's a pilot, taking me out in the Cessna just to feel the response of an airplane. You know, because you could drive from either side in one of those usually. Took me up in like a trainer plane where they had the dual controls. Said, you're going to take off. I'm going to line you up. When I tell you, pull back. First time ever in the air. It was the most awesome thing I ever did. Because you can feel any response. I don't know if you ever experienced it, but you can feel the response of an airplane real quick when you turn. I mean, especially a small one.
Yeah, I have flown on those Cessnas. You're right. You can feel every single movement of that.
If that thing drops a couple feet, you're going to feel it. Air pockets or whatever. It's just an awesome experience. I try to do as much as I can in my life because my motto is, you never know how long you have, and I try to live it the best I can and most adventurous ways that I can. Many people know me as being crazy.
What are some basic precautions for safety when handling engines?
In any field, with running machines, running car, it's all basically the same thing. You know, you use common sense. You don't have big baggy sleeve shirts on when you reach in there. I mean, nothing that could be caught, because if it catches, it's sucking you in. You're done. If I'm not familiar with a layout of a car, I'll shut it off and check it out first so I don't lose any fingers. And that extra couple seconds can save your hands. Don't put your hands in somewhere you're not sure of, is what I tell a lot of people, because you need them.
So I would assume your ears are a really good guide, and I guess your nose. I mean, I can certainly smell burnt fluids or leakage or something, so you can smell those things, but I'm sure you can hear.
When I worked at the exotic car repair shop down here in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, that shop was about, well, it was 7 bays. That's a pretty big shop. It was like in a square, basically. It was about 7,000 square feet, I guess. What I used to do to a lot of people is I'd make them crazy. I'd say to a guy across the shop, I'd walk by and say, hey, you know, that car's got an exhaust leak. I would just make them crazy because they think I'm messing with them. And they'd pick it up, sure enough. Then they would hear it. I'm not allowed to get my inspection license only because I can't drive, but I can sure pick a car apart for inspection and make it safe. I will find whatever's unsafe with that vehicle, whether it be exhaust leak or diagnostic on a vacuum leak, which is common on a lot of these newer cars because they're using plastic intake manifolds now. What a mess. Everything's always leaking anymore. Never-ending vacuum leaks.
So how are you dealing with the computer aspects of the vehicles, the ECUs?
There isn't really anything assistive technology-wise that you can link up to the scanners, other than you can plug some into a laptop, but that's more for programming. I just kind of have to bite the bullet and get some sighted help to read the codes to me to know what direction to go. As much as you want to rely on your natural diagnosis of a vehicle's problem, you always got to check codes first these days, because that check engine light tells you a lot. In our state, we have an emissions program. When your check engine light's on, your car fails emissions if it's 96 or above. If somebody tells you check engine light's on in a car and it's like 96 and up, that engine light is not a joke and it's telling you something's wrong with that car. Before you buy something, you want to know what it could be, because I'll be honest with you, sometimes they're on because it's not running clean enough. With the oxygen sensors are picking up, you know, dirty fuel mixture, and a lot of that's caused by catalytic converters are malfunctioning. And I'll tell you what, some of these catalytic converters are $2,000. And I hate to see somebody buy a car with a check engine light on and have that happen, because you're stuck once you own it.
Can some of those codes be wrong?
It's not that they're wrong, but they're always updated. Now, they can throw you curveballs. You could get a couple codes out of one car. And what a lot of places will do is just throw every part that says in the car. That scanner is not 100%. It's just like anything else. It's there to give you a ballpark. And therefore, you got to take your skills and go from there. If you got four codes, one code, which would be one sensor, could throw all the rest of them out of spec. So you really got to be careful when you're selling parts out here. You got to know that you're selling the exactly what's wrong with that car. There's no guesswork, or it could be hundreds and hundreds of dollars. You know, I'm not going to tell you everybody does it that way. Your average car dealers just throw parts at cars until they're fixed. And I've had people admit that to me. Either they're not exactly what the problem is, or they're cheaper quality. I can go to Pep Boys and get this part cheaper than the dealer. Well, there's certain parts that you should get from the dealer, which are better quality, like when it comes to some sensors, than you would buy at Pep Boys, because the quality is definitely lacking. It will show down the road in longevity and reliability.
Are there any particular vehicles here that you would just advise people to stay away from that are just really problem-prone?
A couple right at the top of my head, and like I said, I'm not here to beat down vehicles, but I'll be honest with you. You see a lot of problems in the Chrysler line of cars. Before you buy a Chrysler, make sure it's in darn good shape, because they have big-time transmission issues, and they always did throughout the 80s till now. They never cured any half of their problems. Another one, getting into the higher-end cars. Audi's a big problem. Always an issue, and it's always big money. If your check engine light comes on in an Audi, if you bought it just because you could afford it and not because you could afford to service it, you're in big trouble, because parts can bury what you paid for it. You know, those two off the top of my head, I can say stay away. Just avoid it if possible. No deal's a good enough deal for an Audi or a Chrysler for me. And I'm speaking from the field experience that I've seen and experienced myself.
Are there certain vehicles you just will not work on?
I don't call anybody's vehicle junk. Nobody's vehicle's junk, and nobody's vehicle's not worth working on. It's just a matter is, can they afford to work on it? That's where the issue comes in play and can be a problem.
Recalls.
Recalls, they're manufacturally all taken care of right at the dealership. I, as a mechanic, cannot do a recall unless I work for a dealership.
Okay, so you can't touch those. But consumers, I know, like recalls.gov,
You can look up different places for recalls on a vehicle. Technical service bulletins, better known as TSBs, on certain vehicles, it'll tell you problem issues. But as far as recall, it has to be done by the dealer, or it's not warranted. We have the software that'll tell you all the, if there's a recall on something or a technical service bulletin on it that the dealer put out, we'll know. We have a pretty big data bank of information that we can go by.
Talk about how you use the internet.
I honestly really don't use the internet for finding problems with cars. I mean, you can Google certain things. But the way it works with most shops, you can be involved in a technical network of shops, works through a company. You can communicate back and forth if you're really stuck and you got a weird problem that's intermittent. Not even doing it for you, but you got a good description by the customer and, you can throw it by other people and see what they've experienced. I just got involved with the internet independently in April, thanks to Cerotech. I have to give it to them. System Access is the way to go. Had a lot of great experience with my internet endeavors here and some research I've done on my own. Before, I had to rely on my wife, and that always became a real pain. You never both have the same availability. She just didn't have the time. Thank God for System Access, and I use it for everything.
So what are your favorite aspects of System Access?
I mean, I'll go out there on the open internet and just use the screen reader. One of my big things also right now, I do a lot of research on, is alternate power. I'm a big solar guy. Solar, wind, I got a big interest in all that. I like to participate, of course, in the chat rooms. I learned a lot about computers. Last time I was involved with computers before I got hooked up here in April was the Apple IIe days back in the 80s. So I'm pretty much lost when it comes to new technology. That's why I do a lot of listening to different podcasts. I like it for the music and the chats. You just meet a lot of nice people and learn a whole lot. Sometimes I don't say anything, and I just sit there and take it all in. I'm a learning person. I believe in no questions too dumb to ask.
A lot of people buy new vehicles under the belief, oh, great, now I won't have to worry about any problems for a couple of years. And it just doesn't work that way, does it?
No, not anymore. In the early days of cars, it was probably a way of thinking. But now the price of vehicles are getting higher, and your average automobile now is anything decent is $30,000 and up. Of course, when you walk into the dealership, they're going to sit you down with a cup of coffee and make you feel comfortable. And they're going to tell you whatever car you're interested in, no matter what they know or think, they're going to tell you, it's a great car. Everything's a great car. Every car we sell. They never tell you until afterwards, that car has a lot of problems. If you find a make and model vehicle that you really like and you have your heart set on, before you go make any deals, I recommend just use the old trusty internet. Pull it up. Check into it. Read about it. Check out some reviews and some of the car magazines. Cerotech even has a Car and Driver. They cover some things. They've had a lot of nice reviews on the hybrid stuff lately. They're all beating their heads together trying to make the best hybrid car right now.
Well, there's Kelley Blue Book, the KBB.com. There's Carfax. If you're getting something used, want to find out the history on that vehicle?
You just brought up a good fact there. Carfax. I'm going to tell you something. Everybody swears by Carfax. Now, it is a great thing, but I'm going to tell you where it's not a great thing. And this might help you in buying a used car. Carfax is only good if whatever damage has been done to the car has been reported. That was paid out of pocket. There's no record of it. And I've checked out a lot of cars that had clean Carfax records, and I know the car had front end smacked off of it, just by looking. Because no body shop takes the time to do an excellent enough job, because most people are, ecstatic. The car's back, and it's fixed, and, it's beautiful. But they don't look at a really easy way to know if a car's been in an accident. Use what us blind people are good for, our hands. Check out the seams, along the hood. On both sides, maybe run your hands across the door lines to see if the top of the door lines line up from front to back if it's a four-door. I blow people's mind and aggravate a lot of car dealers and probably made a lot of enemies, but also blew their mind by going over their car and sometimes in their own repair shop. There's nothing like beating a guy down in his own repair shop. They just stand there and scratch their head. They don't know what to say because they were caught. Carfax. Don't swear by it.
What about flood damage?
Flood damage. Oh, boy. Flood damages, I tell you what, it's really hard to clean a flood damage up to the point. There again, they don't have to report that if it can be fixed. or if they can make it good enough for them, and then whatever they do with it is another story. But flood damage, usually pretty much of that car's life, if you stick your head in that car, you're going to know it was in a flood, because you cannot clean up a flood damaged car to the point, unless you tear the whole interior out of the car and literally clean that car with something good, cleaner, nobody's going to do it. You know, you'd have to take everything out of the vehicle, because there's always mildew or something left behind from the flood, and you always smell it.
What are some of the tricks to make a vehicle look and appear to be better than it really is?
Usually a person that has something to hide will either A, have their cars filthy, dirty, like if it's a used car lot, they won't have them washed. They'll be filthy. You run your hands across, you know that the car hasn't been washed. Well, that's usually to hide defects and flaws. And too shiny, of course. You go to some dealers and they'll be so shined up, and you hop in it to check it out, and you darn near slide off the seat. You open the hood, real clean. They got the silicone spray all over, and the hoses are all sprayed up. Everybody wants a shiny car. For some reason, that's like a good way to pawn off a junker, is shine it up good. If you can excuse my terminology, polishing a turd, as they say.
Are lemon laws even effective?
Are lemon laws? It depends on the state. Like here in Pennsylvania, it's very poor. I mean, they don't really stand behind nothing. But a lot of people I know go to New Jersey, it's right next door, buy a car. Now, you got to pay the tax difference, of course. But over there, the lemon law sticks. You could have a car 2 years, a brand new car, and have a problem with that car, and that car gets replaced. I've seen it done.
I think there's rules like it has to be in the shop 3 times for the same issue before you can even say this is a lemon.
Yeah, it's a dealer law. 3 times on the same exact issue. Bringing up good things, man. That's good. Make sure they document every time that car is there. You get a copy of the repair order and why it was there. And make sure they match if the problem's the same. And 3 times, you do get a new car.
My work at the Better Business Bureau, I've attended arbitrations where the manufacturer was actually required to buy the vehicle back, but I think that's pretty rare, and I suspect a lot of times it's because consumers don't know how to fight for their rights.
To tell you, you can't. A lot of people, if you're told you can't do something, usually you don't pursue it. When people tell me I can't, I pursue it. I become the nightmare in their mind, because I will. There's a lot of things that they'll try and just knock you down and tell you can't do it. I mean, I've seen it for myself in Pennsylvania.
The buy here, pay here lots.
Big nightmares. If you can avoid all of those places, it's the best thing you can do, because usually they're selling pretty much junk. I mean, bottom of the line stuff, and they go to auctions. That car is at the auction. And why is that at the auction? Chances are because they can't sell it on their car lot. So now some used car lot guy is going to buy it. And the buy here, pay here people, they're no dummies. They buy the car. And what you put down on it 99% of the time is what they paid for it. So their theory, and I know a lot of them, I don't say that I like their practice, but when I heard one speak one time about it to another person, and he says, I don't care if they ditch out on the payments. I already got my money back. Anything over, you know, my down money is profit.
Yeah, the thing that bothers me about that is a lot of people using that are some of the more low-income individuals who have less money to lose.
These people that own these lots know that. They don't care.
Talk about your antenna mount business. RFpower.us is the website?
Yes, it is. RFpower.us. I get them made by a machine shop. And they want to see quantity, because there's no money in what they call a one-off, one product, one unit. You know, they want to see 20 units. Therefore, it benefits them to set their machines up. I found a guy, you know, machine shop that was willing to take me on as a small customer. Make a couple protos and make sure it turned out the way you want it. Well, those protos turned out to be good enough the first time around, and I sold them. This is all right. You know, here we are. We're making money. First weekend. And then the second week was a little slow. And it still has its highs and lows, but it's either third or fourth month now.
So these are antenna mount. So either amateur radio operators or people. You were talking about RF competitions. Talk about that a little bit. I thought that was kind of interesting.
They're good for any communications out there. But what they're mainly designed for is high power CB radio competitions. Now, that sounds kind of crazy, but these guys are so nuts, they're putting out as much power out of their vehicle that some small radio stations are putting out. You know, and they go all out. I mean, big race engines, mega charging systems on their vehicles. It's just incredible. But they pay big money. $10,000 pays to the high winner. It's good for military, amateur radio, pretty much any band spectrum that you can find an antenna to screw into this mount. You know, you just have good antenna coax going to it, and you could basically use it as a universal amateur radio mount. You could run all the amateur bands you want. Maybe you might have to switch antennas once in a while. It's got a stainless steel center section where the antenna screws in the top. Normal standard thread of like 3/8 24 thread, just like any standard antenna. It's pressed into a piece of medical grade Delrin that's the insulator, and that's about 1¼ inches around. And then the outside part of the mount is aluminum, and that's 4 inches around. And then we use about 20 tons of pressure to press the center into it. So it's not coming loose. On the bottom side, we have a groove cut around the outside perimeter with an industrial O-ring in there for sealing, where any other companies use just regular sealer, actually silicone sealer. And that's just not neat, ugly, and, you know, I wanted something a little better than that. So I went with the O-ring design, which I am the only company out there right now that has the O-ring in my mounts. And they're actually in the process of being patented right now. And then I'll start breaking them out into catalogs. I'm worldwide with them already. In 3 months, I've sold some to Australia. Big sales in Hawaii for some reason. I actually have a broker over there who buys them from me and then resells them over there. Things are moving fast. This doesn't have a magnet on it like a lot of mounts. This is actually a permanent mount. This is mounted to your vehicle permanently. You actually drill a hole through the roof, and then you bolt this down for 100% ground. You won't have any ground loss, and that's important in any kind of RF communication, because the last thing you want to get is RF into you. They do this on their regular car engine, and how they do it, basically they build a race engine on nitrous, like you basically see at the racetrack. The way I describe this to everybody, the best way, is like a drag race that you go nowhere. They wind the engine up to 5,000 RPMs. The big guys have about 18 alternators at least surrounding this engine with big brackets and plates, which I'll also be selling soon. All you hear when they pull a load down is a big loud whine of these alternators just pounding out the current, you know, 3,000-4,000 amps of current when they key the amplifiers down. And the loudest guy wins. The judges are usually 50 to 100 miles away, dead line of sight, right out from where you are on a flat plain, no hills involved. And the loudest guy he hears, and they record it. No cheating. They record it, and then they play it back.
Can't sustain that very long.
10 seconds.
Thank you, Michael, for joining us today. And again, folks, you can go to serotalk.com to grab his email address. Better yet, why not sign up for a 30-day account? Come in and try out SamNet, including the voice chat rooms, where you can talk to Michael and many other interesting people.
You've been listening to Serotalk. Visit us at www.serotalk.com. Send us an email at resources@serotalk.com or leave us a voicemail at 866-997-BLAB-2522. We may read your email or play your voicemail in the next podcast. Join us in 2 weeks as we explore all the internet and life has to offer. Until then, may you have an accessible digital life.